I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Let's talk about the black elephant in the room, or rather, in the Republican Party. Today, the unexpected politics of African-American Republicans. Some might think that blacks in the GOP are an endangered species, but they are out there. We'll find out what draws some blacks to the conservative platform. Then, everyone knows aging ain't easy, but how many people think it's funny? We'll share a laugh with an author who has found that the best way to deal with old age is with a good joke. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Polls have shown that GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump has been getting historically low support from African American voters. We're talking single digits. But are there still black Republicans? How may this year's race for the White House affect their politics, not only this year, but into the future? Then, what's so funny about getting old? A comedian we visit with says quite a bit. It's jokes for senior citizens or those almost in that camp. That's later on this hour. But first, the news of the day. Early in-person voting has begun in many places in Kansas today, including Johnson County. Still, issues over new voter registration linger. There are developments in this story today, and following that is KCUR's Ellie Moxley. She joins us now. And Ellie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Late last week, you broke the news on our website that new voters registering in Kansas were getting wrong information up until the deadline to register, which was last Tuesday. What was wrong about the information they received?
So we're talking specifically about Kansans who registered to vote at the Department of Motor Vehicles using the federal form. And they were getting a receipt with their voter registration that basically said that they needed to follow up with their local election authority and provide proof of citizenship, you know, a birth certificate, a passport, something that indicated they were able to vote in Kansas. And that information was wrong because there's an ongoing legal battle right now with the Secretary of State's office over kind of what documentation people are going to need to register to vote in Kansas. And a judge has said that, you know, while that case works its way through the system, the Secretary of State needs to fully register these voters who register to vote at the DMV and not require that they provide this additional documentation.
How did you come up with this information to begin with?
You know, a listener actually contacted us and she got a receipt from the DMV. She had just gotten married, moved from the Missouri side to the Kansas side, and was going to the DMV to both change her name and register to vote. And she, because she had heard a story earlier on KCUR about voter registration in Kansas, she knew that the second she read that receipt that it was wrong. So she contacted the League of Women Voters, and she contacted us to see if we could give some clarification on kind of the timeline or why this wrong information was still going out.
You've been talking with the Office of Secretary of State Chris Kobach. Ellie, what does it say about these receipts and this language about voters still needing to show proof of citizenship?
So I do want to acknowledge that if you read this story Friday on our website, we have been updating it as we've gotten more information. What we've actually been doing is we had a timeline on our website that kind of showed the big events, kind of the back and forth between the ACLU, the plaintiffs in the case, and the Secretary of State's office. And we're actually adding additional information that kind of clarifies as we get it. So it's something that's kind of evolving. There's a lot of finger pointing going on kind of who's to blame for the delay. Basically, it seems like the sticking point as the ACLU and the DM or the Secretary of State's office hashed out this what language would be on the DMV results was the November 8th election. Mm-hmm. The Secretary of State's office wanted to make it extremely clear that voters could vote on November 8th, but not necessarily in the future, pending the outcome of this legal battle. Whereas the ACLU wanted to say that voters would be fully registered unless they received some other notice. And in the end, the judge did side with the ACLU, and the language that they agreed to was this language that said that they would be fully registered pending, you know, any other official notice. Except, as we found out, that language actually never was implemented before the Tuesday, October 18th deadline to register to vote in Kansas.
Well, the state is currently being sued by the ACLU, which argues the state's rules that new voters registering at DMVs have to show proof of citizenship are unconstitutional. What does the ACLU say about these indications that voters were still getting the wrong information?
You know, they're frustrated. I've been talking to Micah Kubik, the executive director in Kansas. He's disappointed. You know, the secretary of state is saying, you know, it takes time to make these changes. And obviously, I think all of us can kind of accept that, you know, sometimes the wheels of government turn slowly. But Kubik's point is, you know, this has been going on since basically June, July this summer. There was really no reason in the ACLU's point of view that this language couldn't have been cleared up, you know, back in July. Instead, we kind of went through this back and forth. There was a state board that tried to make a rule that, you know, would create a separate system of voting for folks that used the federal form. And that was struck down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at this point, you know, these folks really should be registered to vote, and they are registered to vote. If you have gotten this receipt that says you need to provide additional proof of citizenship, you do not need to do that. If you are worried about your ability to vote in Kansas, you need to be contacting your local election authority, you know, today. Don't delay, and make sure that you get this sorted out before you go to the polls.
Do we know how many new voters we're talking about here?
Not yet. We will have that number. But basically, this is anyone that has registered to vote in Kansas since June. They've gotten conflicting and or misleading information about the status of their citizenship documents. And we do know, going back to the August primary, there were thousands of suspended voters that were eligible to vote in August during that primary, and only 73 of them ended up casting ballots. Now, we don't know if that's because primaries are low turnout or because there was conflicting information going on, you know, right up until the primary date. But, you know, let me be the one that tells you, make sure that if you're a new Kansas voter, or you know someone that is a new Kansas voter, make sure that they understand that they are able to vote without providing that proof of citizenship on November 8th, because as we all know, this is a very important election.
That's Ellie Moxley. She's a reporter with KCUR. Her story breaks it down with a great timeline of events. You can find it on our website, kcur.org. Ellie, thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
In the world of American politics, a black Republican is a rare thing, even though at one time African Americans stood with the party of Lincoln. These days, one could be forgiven for thinking blacks in the GOP are an endangered species. But they are out there, as our next guest can attest to. That's Corey D. Fields. He's an assistant professor of sociology at Stanford University. He's the author of Black Elephants in the Room, The Unexpected Politics of African American Republicans. He joins us by Skype this morning. Corey, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on, Steve.
In the studio here is Cecilia Johnson. She's from the Kansas City area. She's the founder and executive director of Hood Conservatives. Its mission is to better the lives and empower those living in the inner city through the conservative platform. Cecilia, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Corey, refresh our listeners on just how far back the association between the Republican Party and African Americans goes.
I mean, pretty far back, you know, the origins of the party fundamentally were grounded partially in outreach to people who were, you know, abolitionists, and specifically trying to reach out to free black voters. So it's a long history between African Americans and the Republican Party. The origins of the party fundamentally can be traced back to black voters.
And Corey, when did African Americans begin to turn away from the GOP in large numbers?
I mean, you saw sort of the big shifts happening in the 1930s around the New Deal coming out of the Depression, mm-hmm. right? And so the numerical numbers had been shifting over for a while historically, but I don't think you saw the, you know, sort of single-digit kind of support for the Republican Party until, you know, around the Goldwater campaign, sort of mm-hmm. coming out of the civil rights movement in the United States. And it's sort of been a fundamentally different alignment at that point. So it's not only, you know, I think currently it's not only that black Republicans are rare, it's that, you know, it's sort of that Black Republicans are sort of unexpected, right? That something's amiss about a Black Republican. And that, you know, we didn't see that happening until, sort of post-Goldwater.
Hmm. Cecilia, why are you a Republican? I mean, what attracts you to the party?
Well, I actually became a Republican when I was 20. I just read an article by a guy in a national black magazine, and he was talking about being a Republican, and I never thought about it, you know. So I researched the Republican Party and the Democrat Party and decided that my views and opinions were more in line with the Republican Party. And a lot of the things that he talked about in that article were, you know, entrepreneurship. It was how issues and views from conservatives and Republican Party can help better things in the community, in the African-American community. So things such as entrepreneurship, free markets, education. I'm a strong proponent of school choice,
right?
Particularly in African-American or in inner city, I should say. So things like that really are what keep me, you know, right of center.
Well, Corey, for this book, you spent about 4 years in the world of African-American Republicans, to use your words. How much do Cecilia's reasons for being Republican echo what you heard in the interviews that you wound up doing?
Quite a bit, actually. As Cecilia was talking, I was sort of, feeling like, yes, this is exactly what I was hearing with the people I spoke with, particularly her story about her pathway into the party. That was a very common theme among the Republican activists I spoke with, who would say, that it wasn't that there was some fundamental value shift that they had. It was just that there was a realization that the values that they possessed lined up with the Republican Party. And certainly the emphasis on how conservative policies can benefit Black communities was something I heard among a lot of activists.
Well, Black Republicans are still somewhat rare, Corey. How did you find the ones you interviewed for your book?
Mostly through organizations like Hood Conservative, right? I sort of sought out African-American Republican organizations in multiple states in a variety of different political contexts and started going to meetings, hanging out, talking with people, and had those people introduce me to other people. I mean, the nice thing about studying something like African-American conservatives is, you know, the numbers themselves are not gigantic, but that allows you to dive deep into, you know, deeper into the universe. So, you know, it's not wide networks, but they are pretty tight networks. Mm-hmm. So,
Cecilia, what part of town do you live in?
I actually just bought a house in Midtown.
Did you?
Just a few blocks over east of 71.
Do you find many fellow Republicans among your neighbors? Or do you know yet?
No, I haven't yet. I haven't really talked politics very much with new neighbors yet, but I'm always a minority among a minority community. So
I was going to say, how surprised are people when they find out you're a Republican? Is there a stereotype that goes along with being Black and being a Democrat?
Yeah, people are typically very surprised. And then I always get the, oh, well, you don't look like a Republican. Like, even I don't look like a Black Republican. It's like, okay, I don't know what that means, but okay. But people automatically are going to assume you're a Democrat. I've had that a couple of times at the ballot during a primary that would reach for the Democrat ballot. And, oh, no, ma'am, the Republican ballot, thank you. And it's just...
And they look at you like you have four eyeballs, I bet, sometimes.
Yeah,
right?
So...
Yeah.
I mean, it's fine. It comes with the territory. It's okay. I get it.
Corey, one label often handed to Black Republicans that you address in the book is racial sellout. Meaning what exactly?
Well, I think there's this perception, and I think, you know, this was partly what you guys were just referring to, is that, you know, somehow a person who's a Black Republican is operating against the interests of Black people, right? Like, it doesn't make sense. And, you know, no person who's truly committed to Black communities could be a Republican. But, you know, from our conversation today, we see that that's not necessarily the case. And that certainly wasn't the case in my experience in gathering data for my book and talking with Black Republican activists. I found, you know, it was very common for African-American Republicans to ground their conservative partisanship, their conservative beliefs in a support of Black communities. I think the challenge is, you know, the image, the public image, the face of Black conservatives often doesn't articulate sort of how conservative policies can be good for Black communities as Black communities. And instead, African-American Republicans who, you know, get high profile positions within the party mm-hmm. tend to articulate a sort of more race neutral kind of politics, which gives the impression that Black Republicans don't care about racial issues or are antagonistic towards other African-Americans. And I think in reality, that's not the case. But I do think there are sort of mechanisms within the party that tend to produce this image of Black Republicans mm-hmm. as being that way.
Cecilia, I'm wondering about the political leanings in your own household growing up. What were they?
We never talked politics, but I just automatically knew I was a Democrat. So I just knew we were all Democrats. My mother, I think pretty much my whole family is still on the left side, but, you know, maybe one day.
So when you began to identify as a Republican, was there an aha moment for you? Was it that article you read or was it something else?
It was that article. That article was what really kicked it off. I became very interested in it, started reading a lot of books on it, and started attending Republican and conservative events. And it's just as I, you know, got further and further into it, I kind of, you know, found out what I really believed more and more as I got older and stuff as well. So it was just, yeah, I think that article was definitely what did it, because before then I never thought about it.
Corey, for Blacks within the GOP, how does race wind up structuring how they view themselves?
Well, I think it becomes a challenge because the African-American Republicans I spoke to share very similar sentiments that we're hearing today.
Yes,
in the
exactly.
studio. But the challenge that they face is that when they're dealing with party leaders, many times there's a resistance to talking about conservative politics in, you know, for lack of a better term, such a sort of, you know, pro-Black kind of way, right? And that becomes the challenge. And so in that sense, race structures the experience because it becomes very difficult to sort of promote conservative politics in that kind of way and then find success within the party. So in some ways, it's like the party wants Black people around, but there isn't a lot of commitment towards framing outreach efforts and promoting African-American Republicans who articulate what, you know, could be fairly described as a pro-Black agenda.
Mm. You know, the other side of the coin, it strikes me, is how white Republicans wind up viewing the African-Americans within their own ranks. Corey, you say that generally falls into one of two trains of thought, the needed diversity or a skeptical embrace, perhaps, with doubts about which comes first, their Republican identity or their Black identity. Both sound less than enthusiastic to me. How do Blacks within the party feel about that? What's your sense?
My sense is that, you know, there is a sense that you have to account for your loyalty to Republican policies, and that there are some question and concern. The African-American Republicans I spoke with talked about feeling like they had to prove their conservative bona fides to white Republicans because white Republicans expected, you know, all Black people to be Democrat. And
Cecilia, do you feel that way?
I really didn't feel the need to prove myself.
Yourself?
Yeah, because I came into the party at 20. So and now I'm 28. So it's been 8 years. So everybody knows me. So,
yeah,
I just wandered in and they were just like, OK, hey. And it's just been, you know, that ever since. So but
so,
I know
so
a
that
lot,
pressure wasn't there for you.
But, no, it
was maybe
wasn't.
For others. Maybe.
Yeah, I know it is for a lot of people because a lot of people aren't like kind of growing up in it or whatever. So it's, you know, you just come in at, you know, a later age. And then, yeah, it's like, OK, well, who are you and where did you come from? And I kind of understand it because, you know, 90+% of Black people do identify as Democrats.
Yeah.
So I kind of understand it, but, you know.
Have you ever found yourself at odds between being a Republican and being Black? Have you had those moments?
Yeah, when I was younger, and it was because I would feel kind of guilt, kind of people guilting me into, you know, being on their side with things and stuff. And it's like, well, this is what I believe, you know, on both sides, from Black community and from, you know, fellow conservatives and Republicans. But, you know, I've just kind of learned to form my own opinion and, you know, be firm in my beliefs no matter what, you know, however everyone else is going to feel.
I imagine this year it must be trickier than ever.
Yes.
2016. Yes. Let's go to the topic of 2016. It feels even harder.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't say that because it's been about the same like as when I first came in, because I came in 2008. In the age of Obama. So all the Obama madness was going around.
Oh,
and
boy.
Here I was becoming a Republican. So
was that hard for you?
It was very challenging. It was very emotional time, because the way people were treating me and stuff. But you know, I grew a thicker skin and now I don't care. So I just believe what I believe, and it is what it is. You can accept it or not, you know.
Well, I can't imagine coming of age in 2000. That was the wrong year to come of age.
It was crazy that the things that people would say to me and stuff. And just because I decided to line, you know, and vote based on my beliefs, as opposed to, you know, just basing my vote because someone shared the same skin tone as me.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, there's a great quote in the book, Corey, from a man named John, who was 24 at the time. He came from a southern red state. And Corey, he told you this. It's just that I don't think politics is about black and white. It's about doing the right thing. And that has nothing to do with race. And I'm wondering, has he hit upon something important here? I mean, do we wind up placing too much importance on race in politics?
Well, I think, you know, to some extent, the answer to that question depends on, you know, your where you sit in society, right? And your perception of how much race and like your racial identity affects your life chances. And so I think, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about in the book is that, you know, there's a range of perspectives on that, even among African-American Republicans. So there's, you know, no real agreement on to what extent, you know, race should affect someone's political behavior and political attitudes. And I think, you know, but that respondent, one of the things he spoke to was how, you know, for him, it just didn't seem to make a lot of sense to think about everything in racial terms per se. Now, that was a perspective that, you know, went over pretty well with leaders in the Republican Party. But, you know, you have African-American Republicans who think, you know, race is important. It's just that the best response to racial issues would be conservative social policies. I think the real challenge is finding a way to make room for a range of perspectives on this topic. So I don't know if I would say there's too little or too much race in politics. I think I might say, is there a space to find room to have a range of conversations about that across both sides of the political aisle?
Cecilia, where are you on that? Because I can sort of see the idea that race shouldn't matter. But then again, race matters every time you turn around. So where do you come down on that?
I'm kind of in the middle because I see both sides of it as well. When it comes to, you know, the black community, well, personally, a lot of my views and stuff are based on what I've seen growing up in the inner city of Kansas City. So, I can go around look at those things and say, well, I don't think this is right. This policy led to this and XYZ. Maybe it's not from a racial perspective or point of view, but maybe it's, you know, but it is a problem that needs to be solved. And, you know, I believe that right of center policies would be better for the people in my community. Not necessarily whether it's, you know, a black or white thing, but sometimes it is a black or white thing. Sometimes you do have to talk about race. And the one thing that does, you know, strike me about my party is that, you know, we sometimes, you know, shrink away from, you know, those conversations. But I think those conversations should be, you know, amplified, and we should discuss those things, you know, more openly and try to get our point across. And I think that's also where the black conservative or the black Republican comes in play, and are being able to really get themselves in a position and able and articulate these points and these messages, because I don't think we as a small group, but I don't think we are as effective as trying to get that point across to the rest of the party as well.
Are people here in town open to hearing your message? Other African Americans? I mean, will they listen seriously, or do they blow you off pretty quickly?
No, actually, as I stated earlier in 08, it was very hard to be a black conservative.
And I but, feel for you. That makes my knees buckle.
As it's gotten away from 08, it has gotten easier. And people have been more open and willing to what I'm saying to them. And, you know, just listening to me when it comes to voting and things like that. So it people are surprisingly very more open than they have been the entire time that I've been a Republican.
How are African-American Republicans organized here in the metro, or are they at all? What's happening out there?
Well, we have a few, you know, we're still working on things. And it's just, again, like I say, it's just trying to find that balance between how to articulate your message to the Republican Party, but also to the black community as well.
I imagine some African-Americans don't even want to acknowledge it publicly by coming to a meeting, right?
Yeah. Some are just like, no, you know, Cecilia, we'll just chill over here and just, yeah, you just, know, yeah. in our behind our Facebook page. And it's just like, well, I mean, I understand everybody is, you know, being open and out there is not for everybody. I'm very open with my political beliefs. I have no problem sharing them with any and everyone.
Yeah.
But I understand why some people wouldn't want to do that, because I do remember the backlash that I got just from, you know, family, friends, strangers, co-workers, everyone, just because of my political beliefs.
I can't imagine. Yeah. Well, Corey, where do you think the Republican Party falls short when it comes to connecting with African Americans from a national perspective? What's your sense?
Well, I think in some ways, a lot of the things that Cecilia has been talking about, actually, and specifically in hearing voices already within the party. I think, you know, one of the shortfalls of the party has been not listening to voices like Cecilia's within
right.
the party when it comes to reaching out to African-American communities. I think there is already existing within the Republican Party voices who have put a lot of thought into how to reach out to black voters and how to frame the conservative message in a way that speaks to the issues and concerns of black voters. And I think, you know, the party is going to have to be better at listening to people like Cecilia, you know, and not exclusively, you know, only foregrounding one type of message, not exclusively relying on, you know, colorblind framing of conservative policies, and instead be open to, you know, giving someone like Cecilia a spot on the Republican convention to talk about, you know, how conservative policies might be good for black people.
You know, as someone who's covered politics for way too many years of my life, which is a line I always use in here, but, you know, I know when national Republicans come to town, they oftentimes want faces of color behind them on the stage. Do you get lots of phone calls regularly from Republicans who are coming through town, whether it's a presidential candidate or U.S. Senate candidate, saying, Cecilia, come sit on the stage with me here?
No, I do not. Now I'm offended that I haven't.
Yeah, I was going to say, not
about to start
nobody
sending
now.
Out my phone number just in case they don't have it. But no, but I'm always willing to help out, you know, candidates and stuff that are, you know, running for office, whether statewide or local. Mostly it ended up being statewide, but, you know. Always willing to help out, you know, anybody in our party who's my belief really aligned.
Do you see race being a huge factor 15, 20 years from now when it comes to our politics, or is it changing?
I have no idea. I can't even.
You don't sound real optimistic about it.
I'm not optimistic about it, because it's just a never ending black hole. Just not, no pun intended, but it is. I don't see it. I don't see it.
Well, we'll leave our conversation there. Corey Fields, an assistant professor of sociology at Stanford. He's the author of Black Elephants in the Room, The Unexpected Politics of African-American Republicans. Corey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cecilia Johnson is the founder and executive director of Hood Conservatives, based here in Kansas City. Cecilia, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
And Corey Fields joined us by Skype this morning from Stanford. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some jokes that might be best suited for older folks, the whole idea of humor as we grow older. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, Democratic candidate Jason Kander talked about his close race with U.S. Senator Roy Blunt. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, Lloyd Gaines was rejected from Mizzou's law school 80 years ago because of his skin color. We'll learn about the resulting lawsuit, which helped fuel the civil rights push. And I hope you're noticing our revised theme song here today from Bobby Watson at UMKC. We're trotting it out today for the first time. Well, you may not think it's funny to grow old, but William Novak does, and he's got a new book of jokes to prove it. Novak's book is Die Laughing, Killer Jokes for Newly Old Folks. He co-edited the Big Book of Jewish Humor and has ghostwritten memoirs for Nancy Reagan, Lee Iacocca, and Magic Johnson. In fact, the New York Times once called him the biggest name in the ghostwriting business. His comedian son, BJ Novak, was a writer, star, and executive producer of the hit show The Office. And Bill, nice to have you. Welcome, William.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What's so funny about growing old?
Well, it's not all funny, but neither is it all a sad, slow decline. You know, I'm a baby boomer. I was born in 1948, and my generation, which is now approaching what or is newly old or nearly old, we found humor in just about everything, and I don't think we should let growing older stop us.
Have we lost a little bit of that stuff?
Have we what?
Have we lost a little bit of the humor in our lives?
Well, you know, it concerns me that people, although there's plenty of good humorous material around, we've kind of lost the habit of telling jokes. There is no comedian today who tells jokes in the classic sense, you know, two guys walk into a bar.
Yeah.
And everyone does their own material, and some of that is very good. But when we were kids, at least, I don't know your age, when I was a kid, people told jokes, including comedians. And there was it kind of created a national humor culture. And one of the purposes of this book is to keep jokes alive.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's tell some of the jokes, because it takes a lot to sort of get me off the dime. But when I read the section on memory loss, which I can, I'm of a certain age now where I can relate to some of this memory loss stuff. I was just, I found it pretty good stuff. Page 11, The Name of the Rose. Can you read that one to us?
I was going to start with that. This is the joke I heard most often when I was compiling the jokes. I already knew it, and my wife says, this is really why you wrote the book, because of this great joke. So a long married couple are having dinner at the home of their good friends. When the meal ends, the wives, and this is hard to believe, I know, the wives get up to clear the dishes and the men remain at the table. Can you believe that?
Yes.
I meant to tell you, says the host of the dinner, we went to this terrific new restaurant the other night. I think you'll love it. Great, says his friend. What's it called? He says, oh, I'm blanking. Help me out here. What's the name of that red flower? A poppy? No, no, the other one. A tulip? No, you know, the one with thorns. A rose. Ah, oh, thank you. Turning toward the kitchen, he says, Rose, what's the name of that restaurant?
I like that one. How about the one on the next page, if you can read that long word that you throw there in the second line?
A long word. On page 12?
On page 12, yeah.
I was afraid. I can't read that word.
Well, just make up a word for it.
I'll stumble through it, but because it's good. My wife can say it. Maybe you can say it. A man walks into a pharmacy. I'm looking for some acetyl S. I can't say it. Can you say it?
It's your book.
I know.
I can't say it.
I never expected to read this word.
Yeah, yeah.
Acetyl acetic acid, he tells the druggist. Do you mean aspirin? Thank you. He says, I can never remember that word. Well, you picked the one joke I had to ruin, but it's a good one. I just can't say it.
It's a good one, though. How about the one on page 14?
I just want to say that I think this whole theme of memory loss, this is the big one. This is the first sign of aging, and we worry about it. And usually we shouldn't worry about it. I go on for a minute?
Absolutely, please.
There are, you know, it turns out there are two kinds of memory loss. And the one most of us over 50 or 60 experience is called explicit memory loss, What's the name of that doctor I saw 2 months ago? What's the name of that person at a party that I really ought to know? And these are common slippages of memory. And they're really nothing to worry about. They're very common. Implicit memory, how to drive a car, how to write an email, the fact that you may wear glasses.
Mm-hmm.
If that becomes a problem, it's much more serious. So, you know, this book contains, I wrote a few essays in the book, little essays, to reassure people about some of their worries and even to tell some of the good news about getting older. And now to the joke.
Yes.
An elderly gentleman, well-dressed, nicely groomed, and rather handsome, walks into an upscale cocktail lounge. He sits down next to an elegant woman of a certain age and orders a drink. Turning toward her, he says, "So tell me, do I come here often?"
I like that one, too. Are these original jokes?
No, none of these. There's no such thing, almost no such thing as an original joke or a new joke. Someone said, no joke has ever been told for the first time. These are jokes that you can find if you hunt for them. Some of them are well known. Some have been around for years. A couple have been around for centuries, it turns out, and one for millennia. And I did not author the jokes, although I rewrote most of them to try to improve them, in some cases to make them shorter, a little funnier, and to prevent anyone from getting the idea that they should sue me.
And there's a real art to writing these things, right?
I don't know if there's a real art. I'd like to think I can do it. I've done it a couple of times in the Big Book of Jewish Humor and the Big Book of New American Humor. And now, after a lot of ghostwriting, I'm back to jokes.
What do you know about humor today, William, that you didn't know before?
Oh, in doing the book?
Well, just in general about humor, you know, yeah.
What do I know about humor? That it remains as important as ever. The early reaction to this book has been wonderful because people want to laugh, and maybe they want to laugh all the more so given what's going on politically.
Yeah,
you know,
I get that.
It has not been a funny or a pleasant experience for either side, I think. And we don't have to get into that whole conversation, but jokes seem more welcome than ever. There are also 20 wonderful New Yorker cartoons in this book, all on the subject of aging in one way or another.
Yeah. How about the joke on page 15, unsafe at any speed?
Okay, one of my favorites. Two women are on their way to the supermarket, and they cruise right through a red light. The woman in the passenger seat was alarmed, but she stayed silent. 5 minutes later, they went through a second red light. And this time, she opened her mouth to speak, but she had been experiencing some confusion lately, so again she says nothing. But when it happened a third time, she couldn't restrain herself. "Helen," she cried, "are you trying to get us killed? You've just gone through three red lights." "What?" said Helen. "I thought you were driving."
That one works for me, too. I thought that was just great.
I'm glad.
Well, these are
the
pretty...
I will interrupt, as authors are always advised to do, to say that these come from Die Laughing, Killer Jokes for Newly Old Folks.
These are all pretty simple jokes, it strikes me. Nothing really complicated about them. Do I have that right?
Some are very simple. Some are two-liner jokes, what I call, fast jokes about doctors, for example. Some are more complicated or more philosophical. I end the book with one that's not even necessarily funny, and yet I thought it was meaningful. I'll give it to you if you want. But
sure, go. Yeah,
funny.
Go. Yeah.
Okay. You know, the book starts with memory loss, and it goes through other issues and long marriages, physical decline. There's a section on death, and it ends with a section on the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
And this one... this is the one I close with. When Malcolm died, he found himself in a beautiful place with all the pleasures and beauty he had dreamed of. A figure in white approached him and said, "Malcolm, you are entitled to anything you want, and I'll do everything possible to make you happy." For months, Malcolm enjoyed the heavenly music, wonderful meals, and yes, lovely ladies. After a while, he approached the figure in white. "I've been enjoying myself," he said, "but now I'd like to accomplish something." What do you mean? Well, Malcolm said, I'd like to feel useful. I'd like to make a contribution. I'd like to do some work. I'm terribly sorry, said the figure in white, but that's the one wish I cannot grant. People here don't work. All they do is enjoy themselves. But a life of total pleasure is so boring, said Malcolm. It has no meaning. I'm starting to think that maybe I'd be better off in hell. My dear Malcolm, where do you think you are?
Yeah. Yeah. Lesson learned,
it's
right?
It's a different kind of joke, but yeah, I think there's some complexity and depth in that one.
Yeah. How about the section on long marriages? There's one on page 100 titled The Lecture that I got a big kick out of.
I like that one. There's a section on long marriages. People are living much longer than they expected, and it's no longer than we expected when we were younger, and it's no longer that unusual to find couples married 40, 50, 60 years. An older man who was driving erratically was stopped by the police in the wee hours of the morning. It's awfully late, sir, said the officer. Just where do you think you're going at this time of night? Actually, says the driver, I'm on my way to a lecture. Really, a lecture at this hour? And what is this lecture about? It's about alcohol abuse and driving after dark. Really, says the officer, tell me, who would be giving a lecture at this time of night? The guy says, well, that would be my wife.
Yeah, you sort of see that one coming.
Maybe.
How about the one on page 104, The High Cost of Living?
104. After examining her husband, the cardiologist calls Mrs. Green into his office for a private conversation. I'll give it to you straight, said the doctor. He's in very bad shape. He's got heart problems. He's got chronic fatigue. He's showing the effects of all the stress he has suffered in recent years. Well, will he survive? Actually, says the doctor, that's not clear, but if you follow a strict routine, you may be able to save him. Of course, she says, what should I do? Well, says the doctor, you can start by waking him up each morning with a big kiss. Make him a healthy breakfast and read him stories from the newspaper, but only happy ones. Be pleasant, be patient, treat him kindly, cook his favorite dinner. Encourage him to watch sports on TV, even if you hate sports. In bed, do whatever it takes to satisfy him as often as he wants. And if you can do all of this for a year or so, he stands a good chance of surviving. As they're driving home, Mr. Green turns to his wife and says, so what did the doctor say? I'm sorry, Fred. You're going to die.
What was the hardest jokes for you to come up with in this book?
Well, you know, some people write books by deciding the chapters in advance and then trying to fill those chapters. I learned long ago that the best way is to find the best material you have and form the chapters around them.
Oh, that's
so I only made chapters out of jokes that I thought were good. And they had to strike me as pretty good on the second and third and tenth reading, too, because it's easy to get tired of a joke.
William,
so I didn't have trouble in any one area, but it's always a struggle to get enough good ones.
William Novak is my guest. His new book, Die Laughing, Killer Jokes for Newly Old Folks. So you've been collecting these jokes for a long time?
Well, you know, once I started doing humor books, I kept collecting. I have a collector's mentality. I collect a couple of different things, and one of them is jokes. But it never occurred to me that I would write a book consisting of jokes about older people until one day, it seemingly out of the blue, it came to me.
You know, comedy seems to run in your family with your son BJ doing so well on The Office. Lots of kidding around in your family over the years?
A lot of kidding around, although BJ was not particularly funny as a very young kid. And I was not funny until I became an adult, but I was always attracted to funny people. My wife, however, was voted the wittiest of her high school class, and it was she who came up with the quote on the front cover by BJ Novak. It says, buy this book, fund my dad's retirement so I don't have to.
You're right.
She wrote that for him, and he agreed.
All three of your sons are writers? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
One is a writer of music. He does the music for something called the Mindy Project.
Oh, sure, yeah.
and did the theme for Superstore, and most exciting these days is a show called BoJack Horseman. That's Jesse Novak, and he did that. And our youngest, Lev Novak, is trying to sell several novels and seems to be on his way to a career in writing as well.
Wow. I wanted to ask you about the art of ghostwriting, because you've written so many books with such iconic figures. I'm talking about Lee Iacocca, Magic Johnson, Nancy Reagan, Tim Russert. I'm guessing that's not easy work.
Tip O'Neill.
Tip O'Neill, okay.
Yes.
I've got some of those books. Not easy work, is it?
It's not easy work, but at least you don't have to come up with the story. my worry is always, is there enough here for a book? And I've been lucky enough and careful enough to work with people who do have enough for a book. Some people think it's difficult to write in another person's voice. It seems to come a little easier to me, although when I wrote the Iacocca book, the biggest book by far of my career,
it's a huge seller,
bigger than all the others put together, it was rejected at first for being, are you ready, too well written, they said.
Oh, you're kidding me.
What do you mean, too well written? They said, it doesn't sound like a man talking to you. It sounds like, literature. And they were right. And I had to rewrite the book, and it was very difficult. I had to learn a much more informal style for these kinds of books. But I did a few of them, and they seemed to turn out okay.
Hey, how do you find the voice of somebody else? Again, it's easy to say, but I imagine putting that into practice is extraordinarily difficult.
Well, a lot of people, the truth is, most people don't have a distinct voice. I mean, you may recognize their voice on the phone, but they don't have a distinct way of talking. So there's not that much to do. In part, it's avoiding what they would never say. It's using their language as much as possible. Iacocca really did have a plain-spoken voice, and a couple of the others did as well. But I didn't worry too much about voice, except, when they read what I've written, they may say, I would never say that. So I would say, well, how would you say it?
Mm-hmm.
So I pay attention to it, but it is not the most difficult part, although people seem to think it is.
The approach you take to doing these books, lots of interviewing, lots of research? Walk us through how do you approach it?
Being a worrier, I always worry that I'll learn about somebody who I should have interviewed just after the book is published. Mm-hmm. So I interview widely, always with the person's approval. And they usually give it for everybody. I read everything that could possibly be helpful, including previous interviews this person has done. I didn't spend much time with Lee Iacocca, in part because he had been interviewed very often, and the one thing you are allowed to plagiarize if you're writing your memoir are things you've said before. Huh. So I was able to integrate a lot of his previous statements, because he's such a colorful speaker, into the book.
What do you do when you come across those chapters in almost everybody's life, William, they don't want to talk about it, it's a dark spot, it's something they don't want to deal with, but still it's such an important part of their lives?
Iacocca told me, when I said, Lee, we have to talk about some of your mistakes, he says, I can't think of any.
Is that right?
Nancy Reagan said, I don't want to talk about astrology. I said, I think we're going to have to.
Huh.
If there's real resistance, this is where an editor can play the bad cop, and I'll play the good cop. But usually people know what they're getting into. And there may be things, of course, I don't even know about and never found out about and wouldn't know to ask.
Were there one or two people that you just found so enjoyable you didn't want the project to come to an end?
Yeah, Tim Russert
and
George Stephanopoulos were in that category. Oddly enough, they were rivals on Sunday morning TV shows. I had especially good rapport with George. And Tim Russert was the man you saw on TV was the same good-natured person he was. I've been lucky. I seem to get along with all these people. Some are more enjoyable than others. Nancy Reagan was tough, not because she acted in a tough way, but she would rather listen than speak. And while that may be a great quality in a friend, it's hard if you're writing a memoir. But I've had a good run. I've been treated very well. Magic Johnson was really, you know, to be in that charisma with that in a room with that smile, and a very good talker, especially about his feelings. That was a great experience too.
Wow. You've said that becoming a ghostwriter was not something that you set out to achieve. How did you get roped into it?
Well, I don't know, roped in when I was a young man with an interest in the stock market. And an editor whom I knew, who was working on this book, mistakenly thought I knew something about business. So she said, "Would you like to work with a prominent businessman?" I said, "Sure. Who is it?" She said, "I can't tell you." So I decided it must be the only businessman I could name, a figure named Armand Hammer.
Huh.
And it turned out, of course, to be Lee Iacocca. I knew the name. I couldn't tell you who he was. Iacocca, Ayatollah. There were so many guys like this, or so I joke. And I went to the library and read about them and said, "Sure." You always say yes. You can say no later, but you can't always say yes later. So I said yes, and I'm glad I did it.
So when the New York Times calls you the king of the ghostwriters, how did that sit with you?
I liked it.
Yeah. How could you not?
How could I not? Yeah, there was a time when there was this idea that you had to go to Novak to be a ghostwriter. That time has passed. I don't have any unique secret. In fact, I've moved on. I now tend more to write books, private books, books that will never be published, for families.
Huh.
Family histories, and I'm going to start a new book just commemorating a businessman who died a couple of years ago, whose family would like his children, his grandchildren and their children, to know about his life.
That's interesting.
So I do that as well.
Hey, we've got about 45 seconds. Do you have one final joke you want to kick out to us here that we haven't covered yet? Yeah.
"What are these pills for, doctor?" "Well," says the doctor, "you have walking pneumonia." "Well, how often should I take them?" He says, "Every 2 miles. Yeah. Guy goes to the doctor. "Doc, I think I'm invisible." He says, "Sorry, I can't see you now." "How about one more?" Doctor says, "I don't like how your husband looks." Patient says, "Neither do I, but he's good to the grandchildren."
That's William Novak. His new book, Die Laughing, Killer Jokes for Newly Old Folks. It's been a pleasure, William. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you for talking with me. I loved it.
Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, 80 years ago, Lloyd Gaines was denied entry to Mizzou's School of Law because of his race. We'll learn about the ensuing lawsuit, an important step in the fight against desegregation. Our new theme music is still composed by the great Bobby Watson. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.